Shalom, this is Yair Davidi from New Bambi. New Bambi, Bit.am Broadcasting, Israel. Bit.am, the Ten Tribes Organization, is based in Jerusalem. That is where we are speaking to you from Jerusalem, Israel. Our organization, Bit.am, the Ten Tribes Organization, says that the lost ten tribes today are to be found amongst Western peoples. This is what we have proven. We have plenty of proof and articles concerning this subject on our website. Go to our website, www.britam.org, BRITAM.org, and you will find a great number of articles concerning the subject with evidence that lost ten tribes are now to be found amongst Western peoples. As part of our ongoing biblical studies, we are now about to study the weekly portion. This weekly portion is that section of the Torah, of the first five books of the Bible, that will be read out in the synagogue this Shabbat. The Torah is divided up in such a way that in the course of a year, the whole of the first five books of the Bible, of the Torah, are read out. So this present portion is known as Ki Tetzeh, translated in English, when you go forth. It extends from Deuteronomy 21 verse 10 to Deuteronomy 25 verse 19. It begins in Deuteronomy 21:10, when you go forth to war against your enemies, and the Lord your God hath delivered them into your hands, and you take them captive. So Rashi and the sages point out that when we go to war against our enemies, we should remember that it's what they are. They are enemies. Our enemies are antagonistic to us. They hate us. They want to harm us. They will not have mercy on us nor on our families. We have no choice but to beat them, make sure they never rise up against us again. That is the Hebrew way. That is the way things should be. That is not how things work out in practice, but that is a principle that we should endeavor to adhere to. When you go to war against your enemies, know that they are your enemies and treat them as such. And win the battle. Don't go out with some type of intermediate understanding that you can lose, that you can get away with suffering a defeat, because you can't. Go to battle in order to win, in order to defeat your enemies. Deuteronomy 21:11, it says, "And you see amongst the captives a beautiful woman, have a desire unto her that you would have her to your wife." In those days, if you saw a woman you desired amongst the captives, could forcibly marry her. But then, as we shall see, you had to fulfill all kinds of conditions. It was a great rigmarole. It was not easy. Put a great deal of obligation on the person taking the woman. But it could be done. We learn from this a few things. First of all, the Torah is not racially prejudiced. It is not it's not against people from other races per se, or it's not against peoples from other ethnic entities. There's no law that's saying that we can only go to war against people who are white, or people like ourselves, who look like ourselves. No, it says when you go to war against your enemies, and your enemies could be black, they could be yellow, they could be blue, green, whatever you like. Whatever there was, or they could look like spitting images of yourself. It only required that they be one to harm you, that you had to go to war against them. And then when you captured them, no matter who they were, if you saw among such your captives a beautiful woman, you could marry her. And the offspring of such union would be a complete Israelite. See our article. We have an article headed "The Black Woman." The Black Woman on our website. Go to our website, www.britam.org, and you will see what we are talking about. Concerning the captive woman, it's a commentary known as Or HaChaim, written by a famous rabbi from Morocco about 200 years ago almost, or a little bit less. And he says that the case of the captive woman occurred when the Israelite warrior saw a woman amongst the captives with an Israelite soul. And he understood in order to redeem this Israelite soul, he had to force her to become an Israelite and marry him. Other commentaries, however, are critical of the whole concept. Some have attempted to explain this whole idea of the captive woman by referring to actual practices on a practical level. It was not so long ago, and even in some parts of the world today, it still is accepted that when people conquer another nation, they take their women. In some cases, the women want to be taken. This is unfortunately one of the darker sides of human nature. And by the Torah setting up a whole rigmarole, a whole set of injunctions of a ceremonious conduct that he had to do in order to take the woman, the Torah in effect did not bar the way, did not put an impossible prohibition against taking the female in question. He just made it a bit more difficult and made it quite a hassle, as if to say. And it would have dissuaded any but the most ardent of admirers from going ahead with their schemes. And it also put a damper on the whole thing. A person had to go through the ceremony and put the woman in such a situation and then redeem himself from her and so on. And this took time and effort and conscious, deliberate thought and policies and applications to the authorities in question and so on. But the end result would have been to reduce the spontaneous acts of lust, resulting in less cases of rape, of induced fornication, or welcome promiscuity. So these are things to consider. The Torah dwelt with reality, dwelt with human nature as it is. And the Torah seeks to change human nature, to enhance human nature, to upgrade human nature, but also does not fight against human nature. It attempts more to channel human nature into positive channels, into a positive direction. And so if a person went to war and he saw a captive woman and he wanted her, then he would, after he had taken her, bring her back to his house. She had to shave her head and cut her nails, and she had to change her clothes, to put on a simple clothing, and to remain in the house and to weep for her father and mother for a whole month. And then after that, she could be accepted as a complete wife, a complete Israelite. And according to the Bible, according to the simple meaning of the Bible, in practice the sages also said that there were certain things that she had to go to ritual immersion, she had to be prepared to accept the commandments and so on, that in effect converted this woman, or made this woman become, in effect, a member of the Israelite community also, as far as religious practices are concerned, today we would call it conversion. And if at the end of this period, then the end of after a certain time, the person did not want this woman, then he had to free her. He could not use her as a slave. He could not sell her to someone else. He had to respect her. She had to be let go as a respected personality. Portion continues and tells us that if a person has two wives and he likes one and dislikes the other, and both these wives have children, and the firstborn is born from the woman he likes least, nevertheless he cannot change the preeminence of the children who were born unto him. The firstborn had to receive what belonged to him, what he should receive. The firstborn remained that person who was born first. There was no way of getting around it and had to be accepted. A firstborn child had to receive a double helping. A double helping of which of whatever was available. For instance, we know that Jacob, the forefather, he had 12 sons. His 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel. So how would he divide his property amongst his 12 sons? In a theoretical manner, he would have to cut his property up into 13 portions to give 2 portions to the firstborn. In other words, 2 portions to the firstborn, that leaves us with 11 sons and 11 remaining portions that are divided equally, and each portion being equal, and they are given to the remaining sons. So we find that 11 of the sons received each one equal portion, whereas the firstborn received 2 equal portions. So that was the advantage of the firstborn, according to the Bible. We also told if a man has a stubborn and rebellious son, how he should be treated. The sages said this whole thing of a stubborn, rebellious son was only put there for educational reasons. It requires certain characteristics that would only be fulfilled once once or twice or in history, if at all. But nevertheless, the principle remained, and this, in effect, this whole portion concerning the rebellious son, in effect, comes to enhance, to give some type of strengthening to the authority of the parents over their children in the raising of their family. Also, if a man had committed a sin and had to be hung to death, then his body should be hung on a tree. And it had to be taken down at nightfall. It had to be respected. So too, if you came across your ox or your donkey, the ox or donkey of your neighbour, the bull or the donkey of your neighbour, you had to who had gotten lost, you had to give it back to them, return it to them. And if you couldn't return it to him, you had to take it into charge and look after it until you could do so. You had to take responsibility. The Bible comes to teach us responsibility. We have to take responsibility for that which comes across our path in the course of the day. A woman was forbidden to wear that which pertained unto a man, and neither should a man put on a woman's garment. For that do so are abomination unto the Lord thy God. This is called transvestism. Women deliberately dressing in men's clothes and men dressing in women's clothes. And this is a curse. There are people who do this. It is more common in certain circles than one would imagine, and it expresses something perverse in the person's character. Something which is there, but which should not be encouraged, should not be enabled to develop. So here we have another. We can learn something about the biblical psychology. It might be that a person is born with a certain perversion, a certain inclination in an unhealthy direction, but he was commanded to act against that inclination, against that direction of his inner being, and to control himself and channel his energies in other directions. So the Bible is not permissive. The Bible is constructive. The Bible prohibits things, but does so in a constructive manner. It nearly always gives the person another outlet for whatsoever darker aspects of his personality he has inherited, he has absorbed, he has picked up, is gone astray and let them percolate into his being. And the cure for such darker tendencies, according to the Bible, is to resist them and to dedicate oneself to more perfect, more positive activities. So too, if you found a bird's nest, you had to chased away the mother and then take the eggs. You couldn't take the eggs before the mother because that is not the right thing to do. When you build a new house, you had to make a kind of a... People used to go up on their houses and wander around and do things on their houses. Sit outside on their houses. The houses were flat, especially in the Middle East. And the flat was the rooftop of a house was often used as we now use our backyard. And there's also always a tendency for people not to bother building a little wall to protect people on the rooftop from falling off it. I've seen this myself. This is people who build their own houses and so on. They get lazy or they take things for granted. They don't install security precautions, safety devices, which don't cost very much money or cost very little effort. People are lazy and do not install them, and often accidents happen. So the Bible comes to tell us we have to take precautions, and we should not allow accidents to happen or things which are liable to cause accidents to remain in existence when the obstacle can be corrected, as if to say. Another command was the commandment against sowing the vineyard with seeds, different seeds. And if one did so, the produce would be defiled. You could not eat it. Also forbidden to plow with an ox and an ass, it says in the English version. In Hebrew it says, sure, but it's been translated here as ox. You, in English, an ox is usually taken to be like a kind of steer, castrated bull. I'm not sure if that was the original English usage, but that is the usage that has been accepted. In Hebrew it says sure, in other words a male bull, which would not have been castrated. So too, an ass is usually taken to mean a female donkey, and here the Hebrew says hamor, a male donkey. So why the King James Version chose these variations, I don't know. Usually the King James Version, we find it to be quite accurate, quite acceptable. But there are divergences, which we cannot always explain, and just appear surprisingly mistaken in our eyes. Whatever the case, you were forbidden to take a male bull, a male bull, the English word bull probably comes from Baal, which means master. A bull is like a master, it's the master of the house. In English, a bull is the name for any, in effect, for any large male animal. It's called a bull. You have a different, not only cattle, not only the males of cattle called bull, but also other animals. And in Hebrew, the word Baal can also mean husband. So possibly that is what the word Baal gave rise to the English word bull. At all events, ashore, a male bull and a male donkey is what is being spoken of in this verse. That would also apply to an ox and an ass, as translated. And it was forbidden to yoke them both together. The practice of yoking these animals together was quite common amongst Arab Palestinians. It still goes on in some places. Apparently they've continued it from an ancient Middle East practice. Yeah, the logic to it is that a bull is much stronger than a donkey. And so when you put the bull to work and it's yoked to the donkey, it forces the donkey to keep up with him. You get much more working hours, much more working effort out of the donkey when he's yoked to the bull than you would if he was alone. So it saves a lot of money and a lot of effort. And at all events, this was forbidden. The Torah forbade it. Also forbidden to wear a garment of diverse sorts, or to mix woolen linen together. Woolen linen, a lot of clothes have woolen clothes have linen admixtures. Linen is a harder material. It's more impervious to rainfall. It has a lot of advantages. And a lot of clothing, not a lot of clothing. In the past, it was a lot of clothing. Now it's much more rare, it's much rarer. But high quality, especially high quality, all clothing, but especially high quality clothing, there's always a chance that there will be some degree of woolen and linen admixture within it. We understand from the book by Clifford Smith concerning the Scottish kilt and his own attempts to create a new kilt. Clifford Smith tells us how he gives us a lot of background information into the Scottish kilt, and he tells us how it is made and what different types are available. And he mentions that most of them have some degree of linen and woolen admixture. So in other words, there would be shatness, which is a shatness is a Hebrew word for mixture of linen and wool, and they would be forbidden. It would be forbidden for a religious Jew or a Hebrew under the law to wear a Scottish kilt as made today. However, a Scottish Jewish kilt is available. A certain scholar recently both registered a new tartan and designed a new kilt, which is especially suitable to Jewish people. They may go to kosher, look up kosher kilts on the web, kosherkilts.com with a kosherkilts.com, kosherkilts.com, and you will find more information on this new Jewish kosher kilt. In the land of Israel, the government and also retailing authorities, semi-official authorities who represent the major importers of clothing into the country, have a system whereby they do regular inspections of what is coming in to show that there's no linen and woolen admixture within the material. Nevertheless, things can get slipped by. Also, a lot of people living in Israel, when they come to Israel, they bring their own clothes with them. And some of these clothes could be shatness. In Israel, is the ways of removing the shatness in some cases. In other cases, it's impossible, and the whole garment has to be thrown away. In the land of Israel, there are shatness laboratories. It's a whole business. These shatness laboratories are places where they examine garments to see if there is any degree or even any contiguity of linen and wool, of the linen and wool touching each other or being very close to each other within the making of different garments. So that is what happens in Israel, and these garments may be examined by shatness experts. We're usually ultra-Orthodox, and ultra-Orthodox in the last couple of days, these ultra-Orthodox due to the activities of certain rabbis, of certain high-profile individuals in the ultra-Orthodox community, they've been receiving a bad press, which they do not really deserve. On the whole, the ultra-Orthodox are much more honest, much more capable than any other comparable population anywhere in the world. They are also highly honest and highly reliable. And their actual numbers, their percentage amongst them of those who transgress the law, who are not loyal citizens, is minuscule. Is very, very small compared to that of the majority of the students at the center who enjoy what they're learning and do learn from it. They also commanded, these sorts of commands, to make fringes upon the four quarters of their garment. And after that, but they say one of the reasons why one had to make put these fringes upon the four corners of the garment was in order to remind one where one was, and that people would be examining him and looking at him, and he would have to, if he wanted to succeed, he'd have to make a little more effort than the average. There's also laws against someone who said bad things about his wife, or is claiming that his wife had, when it was she would, had been married, officially engaged to him. In those days, in Hebrew law, it's not the case now, but in those days, before getting married, a couple would be engaged for a period of time, and the restrictions of this engagement, as far as having intercourse with someone else, were even stronger than those of a married woman. And if a person claimed that his wife had not been acting properly, so there was a whole process that had to be gone through, a man could be punished, he could be fined for saying bad things about his wife. So to a woman who did not behave properly, she also could be punished. As our portion tells us, a woman who is, a portion deals with the case of a betrothed woman, a woman who is engaged to another, but the case also applies to any woman, also a woman who was not betrothed, a woman who was not married, a woman who was married, and she was grabbed in a field, or in wherever she was grabbed, and an attempt was made to rape her, then she had to resist, she had to cry out. And if she did not do so, she could be punished, but unless it was in a place where it could be proven that her crying out would not have helped. But we have to resist evil. The Bible wants us to resist evil. That is one of the themes behind this present talk. The resistance of evil. Evil has to be resisted. That is what the Bible tells us. Also says that a mumza shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord unto his tenth generation. A mumza in Hebrew is translated as bastard, but it's not really bastard. In the English sense, anyone who is born out of wedlock. Anyone who is born to an unmarried woman is called a bastard. This is not correct. It's not Hebrew terminology. In Hebrew terminology, someone born out of wedlock is not a mumza. He is not illegitimate. A mumza, strictly speaking, according to the Bible, is someone who is born from incest, or by a married woman bearing a child to another man. And the ins and outs and the complications and the verifications connected with this unfortunate cases are discussed on an article of ours called Mumza. Go to www.britam and look it up. Put the word bastard in their on-site search engine, a search engine for articles on the site, and you will come to four of them, and you will see one of them entitled Mumza, and go there. It's on the Britam Now article, 1126. Another biblical prohibition against intermarriage was with Ammonites or Moabites, but this did not apply to the females, it only applied to the males. And to go to a website and you'll find an article on this subject. Our website is www.britam.org. Forbidden to abhor an Edomite. The Ebonites, after coming into the community, had to be kept separate for three generations. After that, they could be received as full-blown Hebrews. And some Edomites did convert. They did become Israelites in history. And they could be accepted after three generations. Whereas an ordinary person from anywhere else who became a Jewish person, became an Israelite, he became a Hebrew, would be accepted once he was accepted immediately. We have also forbidden to make the daughters of Israelite act like a whore. Promiscuity was forbidden. The Bible is against promiscuity. Someone who made a vow had to pay it. They had to pay it in the time that it was that they had given, in the set time that existed at the time. If someone had made a vow, they had to keep it, or if they could not keep it, there were other options available to them according to the individual case. Someone who was working in the field of harvesting and so on was allowed to take of what he had harvested if he could and eat it. If he'd only take what his hand could gather in, as if to say, he could not gather up a surplus to take back with him after work for his family and for to sell and so on. That was forbidden. If a couple got married and they did not get along with each other, Deuteronomy 24:1 tells us that then they should be divorced, and the divorce had to be accompanied by a scroll, by an official document. A divorced woman couldn't go and marry another man and then get divorced from him and return to her first wife. This was not acceptable. It was forbidden according to the Bible. A man who had taken a new wife was absolved from military service and all kinds of coerced labor that was the customary of that time, or that could have been customary in certain areas. Someone who had just gotten married was absolved from all such activities, from all such obligations for the course of a year. 1 year. And our whole portion is full of examples of these, of different cases, different laws that are given, how to treat the poor, what should be done in such and such a contingency, and so on. So, you know, we're forbidden to put to death the children for the father's sin. Each person had to die, take responsibility to himself. We're also forbidden to oppress the stranger or the widow or the orphan. These people are vulnerable. We're forbidden to take advantage of those who are vulnerable. We had to remember, as it says in Deuteronomy 24:18, that we too had been slaves, had been subjected into Egypt, and we had suffered. We are forbidden, and we have to remember this, and we are forbidden to make other people suffer. Lashes could be applied for certain transgressions. If a person died without children, then his wife could marry the brother, or if he didn't, and if they did not want, it was called yibum, and if they did not want to get married, then the prospective husband, in other words, the brother of the dead person, had to take off his shoe and do a little ceremony in front of the sages, to enable the woman in question to be legally married by someone else, not from someone in the same family. And it also tells us that that we have to destroy the Amalekites. The Amalekites were a foreign people, descendant from Esau, who had done bad things. To the Israelite people, they had taken advantage of the Israelites, and according to the verses, even if the Israelites had in some measure deserved their bad treatment, it was actually a punishment from the Almighty, that as one says, been asking for what they received. That nevertheless, those who gave it to them had to be punished, and when we get the chance, we have to punish them. That is a biblical principle. The Bible is a book that speaks of human nature. It does not try necessarily to transform human nature, but rather to progressively upgrade it, to bring it to one higher level after another. And to some degree we are successful, but not as much as we should be in applying this principle. So that is our portion of Ki Tetzeh, the half Torah, the portion of the prophet that will be read out, is from Isaiah 54 verses 1 to 10, nearly the whole of the chapter 54 of Isaiah. And it tells us that Judah will return before the lost 10 tribes, and Judah will prepare the way for the lost 10 tribes. Judah will rebuild the west places, as it says in 54:3. God had been angry with them, but he will have mercy. And as it says in 54:3, for you shall break forth on the right hand and on the left, and on your seed shall inherit the Gentiles, and make the desolate cities to be inhabited. This has many possible applications. The strongest one in our opinion is that it's what we are seeing today in the land of Israel, when the country is being built up and restored to what it should once have been. There are a lot of faults, a lot of impediments in our path, in the path of the Israelite peoples, in the path of the Jews in Israel. But they are going ahead. Those who can are doing something. And this is having an effect. If you wish for more details, go to our website, www.britam.il. And you will be able to see them. You'll see many more articles. Thank you very much. This is Yair Davidi from New Bambi. Thank you.